Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Come on, I know you've asked this question. I certainly have. What do those big bosses do all day? Anyway, the inner workings of the COO coming up on the broadcast this afternoon from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Glad you could be here on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 12th of June today. A guy named Ali Rogani is the corporate executive in the news on this Thursday. He was, until this morning, the chief operating officer at Twitter. He made the announcement himself in a tweet, of course. But then Twitter, the company, went on to say that Rogani isn't going to be replaced. That, in essence, Twitter just doesn't need a COO. The social network has plenty of corporate company in the non-COO camp. So if they are so easy to do without, well, Marketplace's Sabri Benishour fills in the blank.
What is it that the COO does again?
It's a great question because some people might say no one really knows.
Jill Fish is professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. The COO is often the CEO's right-hand man.
Often they are supposed to kind of fill the gaps, do all of the things that the CEO doesn't have time to do.
That could mean focusing on R&D or production or marketing and sales. Really, it's different for every company. But in general, they do a lot of things, so CEOs don't have to. But they aren't quite the CEO's pet monkey either. Often, they're actually in line to be the CEO's replacement.
It's like a long, drawn-out job interview, kind of a stepping stone into the CEO role.
Donna Dabney runs the Governance Center for the Conference Board.
It's a good training position.
It can also be a very awkward position if you're next in line. Jill Fish at the University of Pennsylvania.
The way you prove yourself as a potential CEO is by demonstrating leadership. If you're the number two person and you're trying to demonstrate leadership, there's someone in the way, the CEO.
But the COO is also a disappearing position since 2000 among large companies. COOs are dropping like flies, really.
COO positions within those companies declined from about half to about 35%.
Josh Christ is with Christ Kolder Associates. It helps companies find top executives. He says a lot of companies are realizing that the COO's job can really be done by other people, like the chief financial officer. And for large companies,
jettisoning that position is a major cost saver.
Maybe you can mention that at your next company meeting. See how that goes. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Yeah, mention it carefully. Amazon Prime used to be just a way to get two-day shipping for a flat annual fee, $79 when it started, if memory serves. 8 years later, and now $100 a year, Amazon Prime also gets you access to streaming videos and, starting today, music. It's not an especially large or current song playlist. It is, however, yet another way Amazon is trying to work its way into our lives. Dan Bobkoff has that for us.
One day, a long time ago, Amazon was just an online store that sold physical things like books and CDs. Today,
the company has reached out and become a true platform. They have both the hardware and the software offerings.
Colin Gillis is director of research at BGC Financial. Amazon builds its own Kindles, has its own smartphone coming out next week. It may even become a delivery company, cutting out UPS and the post office. Oh, and its servers host many of its competitors, including Netflix.
Who would have thought that Amazon's running some major 30-40% of the internet and now running data storage for the United States government?
Dave Selinger is a former Amazon staffer and now CEO of Rich Relevant. Amazon servers will host a revamped healthcare.gov. He says Amazon, at its core, is whatever its founder Jeff Bezos wants it to be.
If he believes he can do something better, faster, or cheaper, you can expect that he will, at the very least, think long and hard about whether he's going to do that.
That's why you hear rumors of Amazon taking on Angie's List and Yelp. Brad Stone wrote the book about Amazon called The Everything Store.
I view it as a company that's simply unwilling to cede any ground on the internet.
Stone says it's amazing how much Amazon is willing to lose on experiments like selling groceries just to ensure it's the first place we shop.
While they think they can do it all better.
Even if early reviews say Amazon Music is just okay. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Wall Street today was down. As to why, I have no idea. But still, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The heart and soul of the video game industry and all of its new toys has taken up residence just down the road from Marketplace Global headquarters this week. The annual gathering, known as E3, is at the Los Angeles Convention Center. So we dug deep down into our travel budget here, yes we did, and we sent our very own David Weinberg to see what magical new boxes and futuristic gizmos are set to be introduced to the world.
I came to E3 with the hope of having my mind blown. After all, the promise of virtual reality was going to be delivered. And even before I entered the convention hall, people were raving about VR goggles. People like Skylar Harper.
Oh, man. You put the helmet on, bro. Wherever you look at, it's 3D, it's crazy. And you get like a little bit of motion sickness, yo. So when you're in the world, you're not even in real life. You're in a game.
I was excited to try on a pair of VR goggles. And I did. And it was cool. But it didn't blow my mind. And I wasn't alone.
So I think it's very exciting. I think it's really neat. I think it's a little scary.
Justin McElroy is managing editor of the gaming site Polygon. He's been covering E3 for 7 years. He says his great fear about virtual reality and about video games in general is that they can be an isolating experience.
When I look at something like VR, it is not a social experience. You know, almost by definition, you're closed out from the rest of the world. And there's a place for that in gaming. Sure, it's just, I don't know that we need to be more cut off from everybody.
My next stop at the convention center was a giant 180-degree wraparound movie screen.
I'm not going to lie to you, Guardian. You are Earth's last hope.
I was there to see the trailer for Destiny, the most expensive video game ever made. At $500 million, its budget is nearly double that of Spider-Man 3, the most expensive movie ever made. And the trailer had lots of cool alien monsters, but nothing mind-blowing. Afterwards, I wandered over to a giant poster of Jesus holding an Xbox controller. It was an ad for GameChurch.com. Michael Bridges is the founder.
We really think that gaming is more than just a fun thing to do. It speaks to the human condition, and we're speaking still through a Christian lens, but we're not doing it in a judgmental way. We're not the morality police.
If you had to guess what Jesus' favorite video game would be, what do you think it would be?
Your favorite game, because he'd want to play with you. You know, he just wants to hang.
After talking to Bridges, I heard a rumor that the video game Gauntlet had a food truck parked outside and was handing out free turkey legs. The rumor was true. I watched a man devour a piece of charred meat about the size of his head. Next to him, a life-size tank was rolling over a taxi cab. It was kind of mind-blowing. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
There are, sometimes, misperceptions that going to a certain upper rank of university will get you a certain type of job. We're talking specifically here about jobs at some of the high-flying companies in Silicon Valley, the Yahoos and the Apples and the Googles. Turns out, sometimes a college degree is just a college degree, and that'll get you a job. Joanna Pearlstein of Wired Magazine has been looking into tech companies and their recruits and put it all together on a chart, which I should say, as we get going here, you can see at marketplace.org. Joanna, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back.
This is one of those stories where graphics really do give you the whole picture, no pun intended. The flow of graduates into these big tech companies is kind of interesting, Byzantine, amazing, right? I mean, it's a whole bunch of stuff.
It's a whole bunch of stuff. There's some surprises there.
Well, what was the thing that surprised you? I've got my own, which I will get to in a minute. But what was the thing that surprised you of schools and then the companies, Microsoft, IBM, Google, Apple, Yahoo, Facebook, and Twitter? What surprised you?
My first surprise was that I think a lot of people think in order to get a job at one of these top technology companies, you really have to have gone to an Ivy League school. Cool. And it turns out that that's really not quite the case.
It's very much not quite the case, right? I mean, there's places like University of Waterloo, which is Canada's biggest engineering school, but also UC Davis, which is known for its agriculture programs and its veterinary school, I think, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you look at companies like Yahoo and Google, they were both founded by a pair of Stanford
right.
graduate students, right? So Stanford, you would think, would really supply a lot of graduates to both of those companies. And that is true. Stanford is the top supplier of workers to Google. However, it's not the same down the road at Yahoo. Yahoo, you know, based in Sunnyvale, the top place that it gets its workers from is actually a state school, San Jose State University. And that's also the top supplier of workers to Apple as well.
Interesting. Apple seems to be much more egalitarian in its sourcing of students than, say, Microsoft, which relies really heavily, according to this graph, on the University of Washington, which makes geographic sense, I suppose.
Yeah, you know, Microsoft based in Redmond gets, I think, the top of the top five universities that it's getting workers from, four of five are located in the Washington state. The people who go from the University of Washington School of Business then go to Microsoft and work in some kind of sales or marketing capacity using their business degrees.
Here's my surprise. And if you think about it, it ought not really be that surprising. IBM draws so heavily from five big schools in India. Which makes some sense, right?
It makes some sense, sort of. You know, IBM has close to 300,000 employees, and about a third of those are located in India. So what you see when you run the numbers on LinkedIn, which is where we got our data from for this piece, you see that the top five suppliers of workers to IBM are all in India. And one has to imagine that that's because it has so many workers based in India.
You mentioned LinkedIn. Explain to me how you guys got this data, would you?
Sure. Well, so LinkedIn, I think a lot of people think of it as a database of people and resumes, and it really is that. But as people are filling in their employers and the universities that they attended, it also becomes a great source of information about those companies and about those universities. So what we did was we thought, well, we can certainly get information about people, but what if we turn the tables a little bit and started to analyze some of the top tech companies and take a look at what universities are supplying those companies with their employees?
You know what we ought to do, or you guys ought to do? You ought to do one with journalism, where people went to school and then where they wound up working. I wonder what that graph would look like.
I can do that for you. I'd be happy to.
Joanna Pearlstein is a deputy managing editor at Wired Magazine. Joanna, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
Coming up.
Consumers are so interested in protein and yet have no idea how much they're supposed to consume every day. So they're just like, well, can't hurt to have some more.
Sure, I guess. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 109 points today, two-thirds of 1%, closed at 16,734. The NASDAQ deleted 34 points, 0.8%, wrapped at 4,297. The S&P 500 took off 13 points, 0.7%, closed at 19.30. Oil prices soared because of Iraq. Crude oil finished at $106.53 a barrel, about the highest it's been in 9 months. Those higher crude prices, along with sagging profits from the German carrier Lufthansa, were not good news for airlines. United Continental dove 6% lower. Delta and American each pulled back about 5%. Those 15-pound catalogs from Restoration Hardware must be paying off. The furniture company crafted a 12% gain based on stronger-than-expected earnings. I will tell you, they hurt, though, when they drop them on you. We got to go. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at marketplace.org by June 30.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday the 13th. Sounds like a movie rental opportunity. In Washington, the Labor Department issues the Producer Price Index for May. A three-day festival celebrating duct tape gets underway in Avon, Ohio. There's a parade and clothes and the opportunity to get stuck to someone. Or maybe you'd prefer some alone time. You're in luck. National Hermit Week begins tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. To go along with a still recovering, just not as fast as we'd all like, housing market, we bring you now home remodeling. The renovation business is recovering, slowly as well. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
In an upscale neighborhood in Portland recently, I could barely find a parking spot. The contractor's pickups were lined up bumper to bumper.
I've been on one kitchen to the next kitchen.
Construction manager Grant Kasten is, installing a new kitchen in a mid-century colonial.
Between 2007 and 2010, things really kind of slowed up and everybody like put the brakes on their wallet. But now it seems like all signs are pointing to a much more improved economy.
Thing is, remodelers thought business would be downright awesome by now. But then home prices cooled and the polar vortex canceled projects.
The housing market is lagging. Its construction is way off.
And that is reflected in the remodeling.
Economist Susan Wachter at the Wharton School says the housing bust depleted the market.
Since 2006, we have 6 million new renters, zero new homeowner households.
Renters don't pay for a lot of new cabinets and countertops. With better weather, work is picking up for contractors, says Sal Alfano at Remodeling Magazine. One popular project is adding an emergency power generator.
The crazy weather we had this fall and winter just got people in some parts of the country thinking, well, maybe it's not such a bad idea to be the only house in the neighborhood with the lights on.
The biggest bang for the buck is a brand new front door at just over $1,000. Alfano says you'll get most of that back when you sell the house. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Traditional brick-and-mortar bookstores selling traditional paper books are and have been for a while now facing tough competition here and in the UK as well. Tomorrow, though, in London, one of the world's best-known bookstores is taking it right at the competition. Foyles on Charing Cross Road is officially opening a new $60 million flagship store, which is, I think, what the cost-benefit analysts call a gutsy move. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The store is bristling with digital technology, including a smartphone system for guiding customers to the books they're looking for. Easy to forget that technology, in the shape of e-books and online retailing, poses the biggest threat to this business. The boss, Christopher Foyle.
Some people think we're mad, some people think we're very brave, some people think we're actually now going to reverse the trend that we're all witnessing.
The stampede away from physical books and physical bookstores may be abating, he claims. The early signs for the new store are certainly positive. Even before it's officially open, Foyles is full of book-loving customers.
I do love the atmosphere of bookshops, the calmness.
It's the serendipity of coming across something that you didn't know you were looking for, which is somehow different from doing it online.
I love books. You know, I do have a computer and I do, but there's nothing like holding a book.
Okay, that's £76.96, please.
Some analysts say these physical book lovers are a vanishing breed, that eventually e-books will command 95% of the market. But Patrick O'Brien of Verdict Retail Research isn't so sure.
We are seeing that the e-book market is really starting to mature already. So we're not really seeing that it's going to destroy the physical book market in the near term.
He says there's no reason Foyle's new traditional bookshop won't prosper. One tradition Christopher Foyle intends to stamp out. Such was the chaos and clutter of the old store that stealing books became endemic, even respectable.
And I've even got a letter in the archive from one academic gentleman who bitterly resented being prosecuted for stealing vast quantities of books. He thought it was his right as a poor academic, his God-given right, to steal as many books as he possibly could.
Foyle is confident that in the new store he can protect his physical books from theft with the use of the latest security and surveillance technology. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Game 4 of the NBA Finals tips off tonight in Miami. The Spurs of San Antonio are up 2-1 over the Heat of Miami, which makes this game super important for the Heat in their quest for a three-peat. Miami season ticket holders were able to cut to the front of the line to get seats for tonight's game, but now comes the hard part, as Kenny Malone from WLRN explains.
It's Sunday night, Game 2 of the NBA Finals, and the entire Peltz family is here. Two parents, three adult children, and one fiancé.
Shoot! Oh, damn.
For Heat road games like this one, everybody comes to the Peltz house and sits on the living room couch. Home games are a bit more complicated. The Peltzes have two season tickets and six family members. The kids have different strategies to land the best tickets. Jonathan, the youngest, would pass on earlier rounds of the playoffs, hoping to lay claim to more important games later on. Until last year, when his strategy blew up in his face.
Looking back, I do feel like I did overreact at the time.
Jonathan was all set to go to one of the first finals games, but when his sister, Maxine, flew home from New York, Mom gave the ticket to Maxine.
Like, literally a 24-hour notice.
I mean, I wish I didn't have that to play that card. I would have rather been here for, you know, all of the playoff games.
It's like a corporation, like the way it goes. She's like, oh, no, but I clear it with Mom.
Angry texts were sent. Jonathan had to be talked down while pacing and fuming, and his sister Maxine considered not coming home at all.
Because he was really mad at me, and I was like, oh, no, this is World War III in the Peltz family.
Splitting up playoff tickets is more complicated than it might seem. Game 1, for example, is not as important as a Game 7, and the first round of the playoffs is far less valuable than the final round.
The NBA Finals can go for anywhere from 4 to 5 times face value.
Depending on the seats, $275 up to $25,000, according to I.A. Ashong. Ashong's with Tickets of America, a Miami-based broker, and he says selling those finals games could cover a good chunk of your season ticket costs. He also says at least twice a year, he turns into a counselor when season ticket owner problems spill into his office. There's an extra game. Who gets the ticket, or should they just sell it and split the money?
Wow, we've done all kinds of things from pulling straws to flipping coins.
But for lots of season ticket holders, selling the ticket is not an option. Greg Gelber and his friends have a ritual before playoff games. They meet at this Hooters in downtown Miami. 7 longtime friends share 4 season tickets.
Well, like everything with our group, it starts with a spreadsheet.
Gelber's a financial advisor, and he keeps meticulous track of who's gone to which games. For the playoffs, they have a simple rotation system, but a complicated set of rules for what you're allowed to do with your seat. For example, if you give your ticket away without prior approval from the group,
complete banishment. Immediately.
You also cannot sell your ticket.
If you can't go, you can offer to trade. If that is rejected, it goes to the next person automatically.
Mike Rosenthal teaches math at Florida International University, and he suggests a method that originally started as a way to divvy up an estate when there's no will.
Developed during World War II by a Polish mathematician, Bronislaw Canaster.
Each ticket holder writes down what a game is worth to them. The person who values it most gets the ticket, but has to reimburse the other members for not going.
It satisfies a property that mathematicians call envy-freeness.
Back in the Pelts' living room, the bigger issue is guilt-freeness, because as much as the kids fight over the tickets, they'd rather go with each other than with their mom.
I wish you liked going to the games with me.
We do like going to the games with you.
It's just that she's a little loud. She swears a lot.
We love you.
Just then, a San Antonio player shakes free and hits an open shot.
Oh, how did he get so open for that?
Every time you guilt us, a spur gets open.
Arvin Peltz, by the way, their dad, he's basically given up on using the family tickets for Heat games. In Miami, I'm Kenny Malone for Marketplace.
Shoot!
I saw a person in line in front of me at a certain unnamed coffee shop the other day get a double mocha, half-calf, skinny frappa, whatever, and then ask for protein powder in it. Now, A, come on, just get a cup of coffee, will you? But also, number 2, that's a true story. Vanessa Wong writes about the rage for all things protein in Bloomberg Business Week. Vanessa, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
What is it with protein and people's diets now? Did I miss something?
Yeah, people love protein these days. General Mills just launched a new Cheerios product called Cheerios Protein.
Yeah.
And it says very boldly on the box that it has 11 grams of protein with milk. So.
Well, what about regular Cheerios? Does it have more than regular Cheerios?
So Cheerios Protein has 7 grams of protein per serving if you eat it dry, which is about double the amount in regular Cheerios. But the funny thing is that most American adults already eat enough protein. We get it from meat, tofu, eggs, milk.
But I don't even know how much protein I need. And they want me to read the label on the back of a Cheerios box now to make sure I get more?
Right. Yeah, exactly. The average adult only needs about, I think it's 46 grams for a woman and about 56 grams for men. So I guess if you have like 4 bowls of Cheerios protein with milk every day, your protein needs are taken care of.
Sounds like
it actually works out in favor of food manufacturers in this case because consumers are so interested in protein and yet have no idea how much they're supposed to consume every day. So they're just like, well, can't hurt to have some more.
That is kind of amazing. I remember back not all that long ago when fiber was the thing, and you were looking up how many grams of fiber something had. So clearly this is like a food trend thing, right? And eventually protein craze will calm down.
Yeah, I mean, this is a hot trend. Even Kraft has launched a new product called P3, which stands for Portable Protein Pack. And it's a little kind of lunch kit that has, or you can call a snack kit, with cheese and meat
and nuts, which their CEO calls the Holy Trinity of craft. So,
wow, that's a pretty bold statement for craft.
Indeed, yes. So craft is also, you know, making some bets on the marketing power of protein right now to consumers.
Everybody's getting in there. Vanessa Wong is an associate editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. Vanessa, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today about Elon Musk and patents, those sometimes mystifying protectors, ostensibly of intellectual property. Musk, the co-founder of PayPal and more to the point, the founder of Tesla, the electric car company, said today he is going open source, basically. He's going to let anybody who wants to, in good faith, use Tesla's patents in the hopes of getting more electric cars on the road faster. Use those patents without charge at all. As excited as he was back in the day to get his first patent, he said, now Musk feels more often than not, it's just an invitation to a lawsuit. And with that, we are done. That is Marketplace. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.